Want a chance to win £250 in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be £250 better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, managing editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. The last three decades have seen China's economic rise. Alongside this, China has become much more influential on the global stage, emerging as a competitor to the United States in many arenas, including as a technology and innovation leader. Last year, China's share of the global market for electric vehicles rose to 76%, and in January this year, a new AI model by Chinese company DeepSeek sent shockwaves through the US tech industry. China has accomplished all this while continuing to be an authoritarian state, which is at odds with many conventional ideas about the relationship between autocracies and technology. To discuss China's technological rise in the context of its autocratic government, I spoke to Dr. Jennifer Lind, who is an associate professor of government at Dartmouth College and a leading expert on the international relations of East Asia. We spoke about her new book, Autocracy 2.0, How China's Rise Reinvented Tyranny, and on how China's ascent was fueled by what she calls smart authoritarianism. Our conversation was fascinating and timely. I hope you enjoy it. Well, thanks so much for joining us on The Ballpark today. Just to start off with, could you briefly introduce yourself and your research and work? Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a terrific show, and I'm excited to be able to discuss my book with you and your listeners. I am Jennifer Lind. I teach in the government department at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire in the United States. And I teach classes on international relations, security studies, great power competition, and also, as a result of this book project, we'll be talking about authoritarian politics.
So just to start us off, could you give us an overview of the current landscape surrounding China's technological rise and why it seems to stand at odds with conventional ideas of the relationship between autocracies and technology?
Yes, I think when China's rise began about 20, 30 years ago, we were watching it with tremendous admiration because of the rapidity of China's growth. But at the same time, a lot of observers thought that there was going to be essentially a ceiling to that growth. People said perhaps China's Communist Party, like other developmental dictators that we saw in East Asia, could mobilize the resources and organize projects and so on so that they could mobilize that early stage growth. People talk about catch-up growth being the level at which you lift a poorer country into basically middle income. And so we were watching China at that stage. But many people, particularly political scientists, economists, were arguing that China's growth could not really continue past that point because of China's authoritarian institutions. And the reason is that once countries make it to that middle income stage, future growth depends on the economy's ability to innovate. And there's this view, a prominent view in developmental economics, it's been picked up by many political scientists, that the authoritarian institutions are going to be very poor at providing the conditions for innovation. And so essentially what we expected was that China's authoritarian government could preside over that catch-up growth, but once it got to that middle-income stage, China would be unable to foster innovation. And what we've seen, of course, is dramatically different from the story that I just told. What we've seen is that China's government has invested a lot of resources and, I argue, pursued the kind of policies that we didn't expect an authoritarian regime to pursue. And as it stands now, China's government has generated significant innovation in the Chinese economy, where China has easily lifted itself into the company of the countries that we think of as the world's most innovative, and in some sectors is actually competing for dominance with the United States and others.
So just to follow up, what specific techniques or policies has the Chinese government used in recent decades to better integrate technology innovation into its ruling practices?
In my book, I make the argument that China's leaders pursued what I call smart authoritarianism. And the way that this is different from the authoritarian practices that we expected is that it actually does permit economic growth and innovation. So what we expected is that China's authoritarian leaders would pursue the kinds of draconian controls and repression that we associate with authoritarian rule. And indeed, that has been a staple of many authoritarian countries around the world and continues to be in some authoritarian countries. So it's things like what we call high intensity repression, very visible, very draconian crackdowns against the population. And then when it comes to govern the economy, you see policies that are quite inimical to economic growth. So unconstrained leaders tend to expropriate, for example. They tend to foster significant government consumption that drives up inflation. And then the governments tend to intervene in the monetary policy, try to boss around the central bank and so on in order to manipulate the economy to their own political fortunes. So that kind of interventionist, economically irresponsible policies is what we expected from authoritarian rule, and we extrapolated that to China. I argue that China's leaders pursued a different authoritarian model, and they did this specifically because they're interested in growth. There's also a political dimension here, which is in my work to create this model, I built on a large authoritarian politics literature that identifies how authoritarian rule has changed over time and points to many different mechanisms. So, for example, we don't expect authoritarian leaders to want to share power, and yet sometimes they create a nationalist assembly, for example, a parliament. Sometimes they allow for the creation of a civil society. Now, of course, it's not going to be one that is completely free. There's going to be a lot of government intervention, but people can still feel as if they can explore their interests and communicate with others and network and so on. Historically, also, authoritarian regimes have provided what are called private goods. So they need to cater to this narrow, what's called a selectorate, to keep them in power. And so the incentive, so the argument goes, is that the leaders will provide private goods to that narrow selectorate. Instead, what we have seen among the more developmentally minded regimes, and I'm saying China is one of them, is that they actually invest significantly in public goods. And this is one of the conditions that's essential for innovation. So that authoritarian politics literature has explored all of these different mechanisms, like monetary policy and central bank independence and the provision of high levels of capital and the building of infrastructure and a high quality workforce and all these different mechanisms, in other words. In that literature, their key variable of interest has generally been political. So they're interested in how these kinds of practices that we associate with what are called hybrid regimes or soft authoritarianism, there's a variety of terms for it. Their key variable of interest is, does this help the regime stay in power? And there's some other political variables as well. What I'm doing is I'm using that literature, but in the context of this big economic question. And furthermore, as an IR person, as an IR scholar interested in great power competition, the bigger question for me is related to how will this help China compete in this great power competition with the United States? So to sum up, essentially the argument is China's leaders pursued these various strands, these various policies associated with what I'm calling smart authoritarianism. We didn't expect this. We thought they would pursue kind of old school authoritarianism that's bad for the economy and that is certainly bad for innovation. And they very much surprised us.
So your upcoming book, Autocracy 2.0, How China's Rise Reinvented Tyranny, talks about the concept of smart authoritarians and their rise in recent decades. Could you just outline what a smart authoritarian state is and how has China been a leader in forging this new type of autocracy?
I argue that smart authoritarian countries are those that try to resolve what I agree is this very tricky trade-off that authoritarian leaders face. And that trade-off is between the need to control on the one hand, the need to maintain control over the country, which is a very challenging thing for authoritarian leaders. And on the other hand, the need to foster growth and innovation. So the view out there amongst institutional scholars, such as those arguing for the superiority of what they call inclusive institutions, is authoritarian leaders really find themselves kind of trapped. They face this dilemma, which is they can maintain control over their society, but doing so will choke growth and will prevent innovation from occurring. The alternative is they can loosen controls in order to foster growth and innovation, but that will unleash the forces that will probably lead to their demise. So in the minds of this more institutional view, this institution's literature, authoritarian leaders are really trapped. They're damned if they do. They're damned if they don't. And essentially what I have seen and what I argue in the book is they've actually figured a way out of this box. They've actually figured out a way around this dilemma. And so essentially they try to encourage growth by loosening controls as much as possible. And when they face times of greater political instability, when they feel like their control is slipping, they then tighten that up. And so there's a couple important points here to think about. So one is, just to be clear, this is not a growth maximizing model. So authoritarian leaders know they're probably going to leave some growth on the table here. They're going to sacrifice some growth when they rein in these forces. A great example is a few years ago when Xi Jinping was cracking down on the technology sector in China. And the reaction of those in the West, many of us looked at this and they said, what's he doing? He's harming his own innovation capacity. He's restricting China's own economic growth. And isn't that foolish? Isn't that a silly thing to do? And so my argument would be, no, he's being a smart authoritarian. So what he's doing is he's calculating how much freedom can he give the economy. And if you remember back at the time, the tech sector was quite freewheeling, quite underregulated in many ways. And so my argument is he probably was looking at that and saying, we need to exercise more control over this sector. So he reined that in, and probably fully with the understanding that this would indeed sacrifice some growth and indeed knocked a lot of value out of the economy quite visibly. So that's the first thing to understand, is they're not getting it wrong by sacrificing some growth, because again, they're not after only growth, they're after both growth and control. The second point to think about with respect to this model is it really predicts dynamism. It predicts constant adjustment. It predicts change. I like sailing, and so I like to use a sailing analogy, which is, depending on the way the wind is blowing and where your boat is headed, you may need to let the sails out. And depending on if you're going a different direction, you may need to tighten up the line. And so I think that's a great analogy, because anyone who sails knows you're never just sitting there holding the line. You're constantly, constantly moving and tacking left and right and adjusting the sails in response to the conditions around you. So again, just as we've seen, Xi Jinping has indeed lightened up on his controls on the tech sector and is now really pushing it in terms of innovation in AI. So that episode, I think, is actually consistent with this model in which authoritarians will provide as loose and permissive conditions for growth as they can while constantly adjusting depending on what's prudent for their regime.
You've just mentioned tech and AI. Thinking about AI development in China, how does China's leadership in this area reflect its rise as a smart authoritarian state?
I think this is very connected. First of all, this is a sector that has risen very rapidly. This is a sector that's very dependent on having a very high-trained science and technology workforce. So again, lots of science and technology PhDs, lots of engineers, lots of science and technology bachelor's degrees. And so that's one area where the smart authoritarians excel, because they know they have to provide that workforce. It's also evidence of smart authoritarianism in action in that there's tremendous capital investment that's necessary, not just the government investing a lot of money, although that's a really important element too. We could talk about that as a separate issue related to industrial policy, but also providing macroeconomic stability, which, as I noted, is not necessarily something authoritarians often do, providing that macroeconomic stability to encourage investment, providing a financial market that has much improved relative to the past. I remember when people talked about people being scared to invest in China's stock market and so on, because it was a bit of a wild west, I think it was described. So there's all these different elements related to government policy that have set the stage for why China has been able to excel in this sector. And when we look at it, this is one of the sectors in which China is competing for dominance. This is not just, oh, they're doing pretty well. This is a sector in which China and the United States are really rivaling each other for dominance, for who can be the first to agentic AI, right? So this is this race, and China is competing in it very hard. In terms of some of the metrics we look at, one is patenting, and China is sort of neck and neck with the United States there. One is research publications in the AI sector specifically. And if you look at the aggregate numbers, China is soaring above others in terms of the volume. If you adjust for high quality publications, which is an important adjustment I think we need to make, again, the picture is very much this kind of two tech superpower world with China and the United States really being quite dominant on that metric too.
So how does being a smart autocracy now help China to compete globally?
Because China's government pursued this model, it defied our expectations. It enabled China to continue to foster economic growth when we didn't think it would be able to do that. And so there's a big question as to, is this going to lift China into the echelon of the high-income economies, which is a really interesting question, particularly of interest to economists. I find in my field, and when I'm thinking about great power competition, it's actually less relevant in that historically, countries have not needed to be a high-income economy in order to compete very hard in world politics. And the Soviet Union is a great example of that. They never reached high income. But it is something that is on the horizon. And so it is quite possible that China will defy expectations and lift itself into that category. And essentially, it's an argument that China's rise will continue, that China will continue to be a formidable economic competitor when we expected that because of its authoritarianism, it would only be good at screwing things together that were invented by other countries, at kind of an assembly sort of an economy. And this has absolutely been shown to be false, that China is quite innovative in a number of sectors, dominant in others. And so it's going to be a formidable economic competitor. Politically, there's a really important lesson from this as well, which is because China is such a formidable market, because it's such a formidable technological power, it's going to be a more politically influential country in the world. And so it's going to want to have a say in shaping the rules of international order. It's going to very much be supportive of other autocratic states around the world. This is one theme that we've seen already with the Ukraine war, with China's support of Russia. Also, there are governments around the world that can look to China for support when they're having tough times. If they need police forces or maybe even forces for suppression in response to public protests. So it's this idea of China not just as a formidable economic competitor, but China as a great power with the potential to affect politics all over the world. So having an authoritarian superpower that's one of the richest countries in the world is just going to be transformative in world politics, and not in a way that's going to make a lot of your listeners happy. We don't like the idea of this strong authoritarian country that's going to be encouraging authoritarian governments to stay in power, supporting them staying in power, and generally encouraging the spread of authoritarianism around the world and the regression of democratic rule. So there are profound economic impacts of this. And then, of course, this will lead to profound political effects as well.
So how has China's economic rise challenged ideas about autocracies blocking innovation? And what implications does it have in the context of the so-called superpower contest between China and the US?
What China showed us is there is this model out there that we actually didn't put much stake in. So the model we were first introduced to was this, it's a bit of a black swan, which is Singapore. It's a tiny city-state, and it was one of these East Asian tigers, as they were called, one of the East Asian miracle economies that lifted its people from low income into the middle income category. And actually, it didn't liberalize like its neighbors, South Korea and Taiwan. It stayed an authoritarian state. The authoritarian leaders maintained control in Singapore. And yet they were able to lift their country into the high income category. So there was this model out there that we saw, but we said, you know, it's this very tiny city state. This seems like it couldn't possibly be a model for the 1.4 billion people of China. And essentially what we've seen is China has learned a great deal from Singapore's model. It actually did so in a very direct fashion, where Singapore's leader, Lee Kuan Yew, which is one of the kind of original smart authoritarians, I would say, would come to China, would advise Deng Xiaoping and other Chinese leaders and give them explicit, direct advice as to how to do this. And China's leaders were keenly listening. And what we've seen with China's rise and technological rise, even more importantly, is that this model that we thought was this bit of an accident or a black swan, this model actually can work elsewhere. And so obviously, because China is one of the most important countries in the world and a massive country in the world, the fact that it works there is hugely consequential. But what we're also seeing is many countries around the world, authoritarian countries, are quite interested in this model. They were actually talking to Lee Kuan Yew before. He made lots of trips, many travels, and he advised many countries about how to maintain authoritarian control while encouraging growth and even innovation. And now we see other countries, particularly in the Middle East, where the UAE is directly emulating China and Singapore. Saudi Arabia is pursuing a similar course. There's many countries that are looking to this model as a way of maintaining authoritarian rule, but also participating in the 21st century innovative economy.
How has the U.S. responded to China's technological rise? And how effective have these measures been? Do you foresee a scenario in which Beijing will replace Washington as the global leader in technological innovation?
Well, the U.S. basically for many years facilitated China's technological rise with what we call the engagement policy toward China that really accelerated in the 1990s. The United States was supporting China's economic growth and allowing significant technology transfer. Even when we look back and we think that was kind of crazy in terms of individual firms basically giving away all of their technology to what could then be competitors. But I think there was a lot of hubris on the part of these firms. There were a lot of problems of collective action that China exploited. Namely, it offered the potential to access the Chinese market, to bid for government contracts and so on, but only if you were an investor in a Chinese joint venture and only if you were transferring technology. And so many firms thought that was a bet they were willing to take. And the U.S. government sat back and watched while this happened. And so basically you see American firms essentially transferring the technology to what would later become their competitors. And this was essentially, as I said, part of a broader U.S. policy of supporting China's economic rise. And that policy was motivated in this broader philosophy. It's a broader kind of theory that people had in their minds that if we supported China's economic growth, if we encouraged the development of a middle class, that would lead to demands amongst China's people for political liberalization. And I think that very much did pan out, although not in the way we anticipated, but we do see China's government becoming much more attuned to the demands of the people. We do see better governance in China over time, but we don't see elections, right? And that was the kind of thing that the Americans were expecting. And so essentially, the Americans had this idea, we talk about modernization theory, right? Where as the country becomes richer, as it moves up the ladder from lower to middle to upper per capita GDP, we expect liberalization will occur. And smart authoritarianism threw a wrench into all of those ideas. So I don't want to say that was a crazy idea that the U.S. had. I think there was a sound basis for it in many ways. Right now, we're all playing, it was your fault and you were stupid and why did you do that policy? And nobody wants to own the policy because it clearly didn't pan out the way we'd hoped. So there's a lot of finger pointing in Washington. But the idea was, again, I think a defensible one. It's a risky one. What the people in the more kind of realist school were telling us all along, they turned out to have really gotten this right. the argument, again, was based on forces that we have seen in action and forces that, as I just mentioned, we saw in action in South Korea and in Taiwan, which is as those countries became wealthier, as they gained this middle class, we did see demands for greater political representation. And we did eventually see democratization. So again, it was not a crazy idea, but many scholars on the more realist side of the ledger would say, when you're dealing with a potential great power rival with a potential superpower, that's a very risky bet to take. And it turns out that we got the wrong end of that. Many people might think that I'm making an argument about the superiority of China's method, of the superiority of Chinese institutions. And we can compare them, we can contrast them. I think that China's model has some advantages. And I think one of the key flaws in these institutional arguments and these institutional debates within my field of international relations is we compared the weaknesses in Chinese institutions with the strengths in democratic institutions. And we didn't consider the other side of the ledger for either one. And so essentially, I think it's important to do that. There are weaknesses in democracies. We're routinely accused of short-termism, for example, where short-term thinking and in the US, the need to provide immediate returns to shareholders and this sort of thing that would neglect long-term innovation and investment. So that's an example of what are the different ways in which actually democracies might be disadvantaged at innovation? And are there ways in which authoritarian societies, for example, those that are able to identify certain sectors they want to build up, like AI, for example, like quantum computing, and then direct a tremendous amount of capital to those sectors. I mean, that is an advantage, at least in many cases. So just taking a step back, what I'm saying is there are going to be advantages and disadvantages to both models. I happen to believe that arguments about an authoritarian advantage overall are something that we should really be skeptical of. I think we should remember the strengths of our model. We should remember the strengths of relying on the market, not the completely unrestricted market, but generally allowing the market to direct where financing goes and so on. I think there's good arguments for that. They're not in vogue at the moment because we're seeing a phenomenally successful industrial policy. But generally, this is an evergreen debate, and we continually move back and forth between the market knows all, just rely on the market. And then we encounter some success stories of industrial policy. And then the pendulum swings back in the other direction. And we say, we must have an industrial policy. So I would just remind us that really is an evergreen debate as to industrial policy. And I think that basically with smart authoritarianism, in contrast with democracy, this is going to become an evergreen debate as well. We didn't think there was a debate there, which is the key insight that I'm hoping my book really draws attention to. We thought there was a democratic advantage. And so I'm arguing smart authoritarian regimes can be competitive, even maybe dominant in some sectors where perhaps there's something about authoritarianism that conveys a particular advantage in that sector, in that technology, in that type of innovation, for example. So they can be competitive. I think the jury is definitely still out on whether or not they would be superior. And so I still very much prefer the model of the Western liberal democracies.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
So thinking about that competitiveness then, is there a way in which American policymakers should account for or even accommodate China's economic and technological innovation? Or is the current administration right to remain confrontational towards Beijing's digital power?
There's a big debate going on in the United States, which is, to what extent should we try to isolate China, distance China, try to deny it technology and so on as a way of trying to hinder it from competing in innovation? Versus, is this actually harmful for the United States if we go after it in this way, particularly when a lot of its trading partners and research and technology partners are not enthusiastic about doing that? So, for example, if the US insists on a variety of export controls, is it likely that various trading partners will start to what's called design out the United States from supply chains? because having the U.S. technology in your supply chain comes with all of these very onerous restrictions about what can you do with this, where can you export it, and so on. And we have seen this in various other historical cases. And again, the big question is, are we, by going after China in this way, harming American firms, harming American technology, harming American innovation? But the flip side of this is you're providing a military rival with the vital technologies that they need to build the weapon systems, to build the surveillance systems, targeting systems, computers, communications that they're going to use to potentially fight a war with you. And that is a very, very difficult debate. And so the kind of economic realities come up against the political realities. And essentially, I think we see where you sit is where you stand, right? The economic stakeholders say, hey, we really should be trading with China, and saying, please don't restrict our ability to trade with China. But then what critics of trading with China are worried about are that we are, in Lenin's memorable phrase, selling the rope with which we will hang ourselves. And so obviously we want to avoid that situation. So how this all plays out really is going to depend on, I think, current events, developing events. For example, if China flies a spy balloon over the United States, that sends us into this chill and really empowers the military stakeholders and the people sounding the alarm about China, and probably leading to a tightening up on the economic side. If US and Chinese leaders can actually create what looks like sort of amiable relations and avoid crises and so on, maybe that will give more power to the voices arguing that we can actually trade together.
In an episode of The Ballpark you appeared on last year with Professor Michael Mastantuono, you explored the US's use of technology export controls against China. What changes have occurred since then with regards to these measures, especially considering President Donald Trump's tariff war and China's ambitions now to compete with other world-leading technology developing countries like Japan?
Yes, this is, as I was just talking about, the issue of whether or not to impose export controls on China is really central to U.S. foreign policy right now. And we obviously have imposed export controls that we've negotiated with a variety of partners that are key in that semiconductor supply chain. So the broader idea was, particularly in this field of AI, where innovation is young and rapid and taking off, and where this sector is thought of as being really pivotal in what's going to drive future prosperity, future commercial innovation, as well as military innovation and military war fighting. This was a sector in which China had a key vulnerability, namely, it didn't manufacture the semiconductors, the highly cutting-edge semiconductors that are necessary for training AI models. And so there was this key vulnerability there, and this key advantage that the United States had, which is the countries that were key in this supply chain were all U.S. security partners. And so the United States took advantage of that situation, and this is the phenomenon that political scientists have referred to as weaponized interdependence. The U.S. took advantage of first its control or influence over the supply chain on the one hand, and then China's vulnerability on the other, to impose export controls with the goal of slowing China's progress in this key developing sector. And what's changed over time is essentially we have expanded the export controls reacting to technological changes, so that the number of controls has expanded, the number of different technologies involved has expanded. And we've also, while that's been going on, we've been watching actually significant innovation occur in China's semiconductor sector. And so this was certainly not what we had hoped for. There was a sort of implicit debate going on about these export controls, which is, in one view, these export controls are going to slow China down because they'll be unable to access the fundamental technology that they need. The competing view, however, is the necessity is the mother of invention view, which says if you deny them the equipment that they need, they're going to be forced to figure out a way to get it, or they're going to be forced to innovate themselves. And essentially, what we've seen borne out is that latter view. So China's growth in AI has certainly been slowed. I think that's absolutely true. It would be at a stronger position had it been able to access from the beginning the NVIDIA semiconductors that it needed, had it been able to import these EUV machines from the Netherlands that are essential in manufacturing semiconductors. So absolutely, China would have been more advanced. But the problem is that we also seem to have jump-started some Chinese innovation that may not have occurred. So again, China learning to do more with less and seeing semiconductor firms in China becoming more advanced, being able to compete at these 7-nanometer level, the 5-nanometer level, and then moving toward the global cutting edge where still China isn't there. But the question is, will they actually get there? So essentially what we've seen is that we were trying to deny China the ability to compete in AI and in some respects slow them down. But in other respects, we really encourage what had been a lagging Chinese semiconductor sector to really start producing some world-changing innovation. In the case of DeepSeek, for example, this was truly remarkable, and it shows that China reacted to scarcity by getting more out of the fewer chips than it was able to access. And so this is a profound move forward. And it's something, again, that really was quite an earthquake through Washington, D.C., that a Chinese firm was able to do that when American firms like NVIDIA, like others, were being denied the ability to sell in the Chinese market. But the reasoning was, but we're going to slow them down so much, this is worthwhile. And then we see them doing this profound innovation of that type. So essentially what we're seeing is we had hoped that the export controls would significantly slow them down. Instead, what we're seeing is China Semiconductor has really responded by becoming much more innovative. And so that's something that is going to make these already politically challenging export controls more difficult to keep going.
So just before we finish, and I know we've spoken about your upcoming book as well, I'd like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any other recent or upcoming projects, articles, that sort of thing that you're working on that you think they might find to be of interest.
Yes, thank you so much. As we've been talking about, Professor Masanduno and I co-authored an article on the export controls, and I'm happy to say that that article has been published. It's in the current issue of Texas National Security Review, and so we can post that for listeners who are interested. And again, what we do in that article is we look to lessons from the Cold War regime, the Cold War technology control regime called COCOM, and we spin those out for what we can learn about the current regime. I'd also direct listeners to a Substack that I have founded and that I edit, which is a collaboration between myself and other scholars of international relations and foreign policy. We're called Blue Blaze, and it's a free subscription, and so I hope people will subscribe.
And listeners can find links to those resources on our show notes. Just remains for me to say, Professor Jennifer Lin, thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Dr. Jennifer Lind is an associate professor of government at Dartmouth College. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks so much to Dr. Jennifer Lind for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Avan Fata. A theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and unlike lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @lse_us, and tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.